okay, so you, the stuff you said made me think of two things. One is Eric Samoot has a ridiculous, amazing arrangement of some tunes from Porgy and Bess.
Oh,
that
yeah,
I,
yeah.
Brian Mueller has a recording. I'm sure a couple other people on YouTube.
I've seen Eric do it. Oh, it's
yeah,
gorgeous.
I've seen it too. Yeah, I mean, it's
yeah,
impressive. And then the other thing is you mentioned John Corigliano, who actually, if you remember from like episode 2 or something like that, almost wrote a piece for Lee when
All
that
right.
NBA commission thing came around. And there was sort of, I remember reading about John wanted some sort of six mallet thing, and he had this weird sort of theatrical concept, and it seems like it just never got off the ground. Lee, have you ever thought about commissioning him to write that work that never was?
Yeah, I have thought about it. You know, I'm going to have to change positions here because I'm going to run out of gas on you guys. So I'm going to have to go upstairs to another office and plug into a power outlet, if you don't mind.
Sure. Yeah, no worries.
This isn't too disturbing. But yeah, so the Coriolano idea is one of these things where the composer got way ahead of himself before we actually met in person. And so John had the idea of starting the piece with six mallets and then going to 5-4-3-2. So anyway, so John started. So when we met, I'm trying to think whether I was in Asbury Park at that point or still in Manhattan. But in any event, he said, okay, this is going to be, he had to have sort of a hook to get his imagination going. He had to have an idea. If you know his piano concerto, you know, each piece has a concept with it. And so his concept was go 6-5-4-3-2. And except it was sort of fatally flawed because he said, well, you can make so much more sound when you have just one stick in each hand, right? And I said, no, John, actually, it's really the other way around. If you write these types of patterns or whatever with four mallets, I said, I can do okay with six mallets. And I was working on the original sketch, which some very pretty chords, because I showed him how I was able to roll with three mallets in one hand. And I was doing a thing where it was going like, if you go 1-6, it would go like 6-5-4, 6-5-4, 6-5-4. And I rolled that way and sustained just in one hand those three pitches. And so, and then the idea of the opening, I have the sketches again downstairs, but you know, that, and then that was sort of fading out while another chord faded in and then going down the instrument. And then that developed, eventually dropping a stick and so forth. But he was hung up once he had the idea that it had to be 6-5-4-3-2. And I was trying to talk him into, you know, maybe coming back to four or something. If you want a lot of sound out of the instrument, it's more about the patterns that you're playing, not really whether it's four mallets or two. But he sort of saw four mallets, or somebody told him at the New York Philharmonic that if you have four mallets, you really can't play very dexterously because they get in the way of each other. So, and then the real killer for that project was, I had a $5,000 grant to work with, and the Metropolitan Opera came around with a $100,000 commission for The Ghosts of Versailles. And so he dropped the marimba piece, promised to get back to it a half a dozen times, and I haven't really pushed it in many, many years. But I do have the sketches there, and it's, you know, it's sort of, I could put it in the bucket.
Yeah,
on the bucket list to go back to him and say, "Hey, John, remember this? Let's do it."
$5,001.
So, Lee, one of the things you had mentioned was tuning, and in my research, I had to look up which episode this was. On Rebecca Kite's episode, we talked about Claire Omar Musser, who, from my understanding, was really the person that pushed the Deacon Marimbas to the next level. Then, obviously, ended up splitting off and forming his own company, which I think you would agree is sort of the spiritual predecessor to your own company. And there's not too many people I can think of that have personal experiences with Claire Omar Musser. So could you tell us about meeting Mr. Musser, the man, and what he was like?
Well, the first thing is that Claire Musser contributed on many different levels to the marimba. We know he wrote some pieces that, while some people might make fun of them because, well, back in when I was at Eastman, when serial music was all the rage, Musser etudes were considered to be silly. But if you can play the hell out of the Mussorgsky C major or B major, any audience on planet Earth will love it. And while there are parallel fifths and resolutions of the seventh that don't resolve properly and some other school issues that Claire didn't know about, he contributed some important literature to us on one level. The next thing was when he worked for Deegan, he contributed the idea of making the marimba into something that you'd be proud to have in your living room. Prior to that, it was just really like sticks of metal on the frame. And the bars were there. It was a novelty instrument, more for the funny sounds that it made. And he was the person who thought, you know what, let's make this beautiful so that people will want to have it in their living rooms. And so a series of Deegan instruments, King George, Century of Progress, and Diana, and the other instruments that he made got progressively more ornate and beautiful. And when he left Deegan, that's a long story in and of itself as to all the ins and outs of that, which maybe I've talked about elsewhere, and formed his own instrument company, he brought with him some of the great Deegan employees. Because they were not happy with the way they were being treated at Deegan, the way some of their comrades were being treated after World War II and they came back from the war. Certain people weren't rehired, which was really, really in bad taste for that time and the culture of the post-World War II period. So he had great tuners there. Claire was not, to my knowledge, really knowledgeable so much about the tuning. That was Paul Filkowski, was his guy who worked there. And as Vida Chenoweth, I guess Vida summarized it better than anybody could, she would say Claire was half genius, half crackpot. And I think that sort of sums it up. When I was at his house in Studio City, he took me into his little lab and played me a Glockenspiel bar that had been made from a meteorite. And I know there's a lot of talk about this. It was hideous. It was so poorly tuned. It was like so conflicted. You could not use it as an anvil. It was such a bit, but he was just enamored with the idea of making a whole Glockenspiel out of meteorites.
I'd buy it.
Yeah, you know, you'd buy it. I mean, you'd have fun with it.
we talked about that on I think it was the episode we talked about Musser, and he did. And the only That's thing crazy. That wasn't made of space material were the screws. Like, I think the entire frame even was made of space material.
Oh, never mind. I don't want
by
it.
Outer space.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but you know what? With Claire, though, you can't be absolutely sure. Because when I bought his Canterbury marimba from him, I ended up being the highest bidder. When he was moving from Studio City to an apartment, he had to get rid of a lot of his stuff. I wish I could have bought a Steinway, actually. I didn't have the dough for that. But he wrote me these ornate, flowery letters that I'll probably leave to the Percussive Arts Society, talking about how the wood on this particular keyboard was grown on the volcanic slopes of, you know, these like mystery islands and so forth. He was really good at dressing things up. So who knows, on the Celestrophone, is that what it was called?
Yeah.
Do a lot of drugs?
No, it came naturally to Claire.
Oh, he didn't need drugs. Yeah, he was just always in that state.
You know, a really, really interesting, funny guy, an entrepreneur in the best sense of the, and man, he loved the marimba and he did so much. The whole concept of the marimba orchestra to get more people to buy the marimba, to get 100 people together, let's get 100 sales on this. And he was a great, he was a marketing genius also.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answered your question. I forget what the question was, but something.
Yeah, just what was he like as a person? Yeah. I mean, he just seems so fascinating to me with, I mean, like the, he developed some, I can't even remember, it was some sort of system that would show planetary orbits. I mean, completely unrelated to music.
He used aircraft for a while in their education department, I guess, developing teaching aids for the classroom to teach astronomy.
Mm.
And I think that was one of his projects. He was working on a model, like you'd have a globe in the classroom. Well, at that time, in the 60s, with the space program, I mean, globe was kind of boring. You wanted to have all the planets and orbiting and the moon going around and so forth. So I don't think I ever saw that completed prototype, but I know that that's something that he was working on.
Yeah, I remember I did find the actual, like, the patent and everything for it. Yeah, oh. if you look around online, it's out there somewhere. Yeah.
I mean, one of the things is Claire used to say, "Oh, I have 125 patents or whatever." And I mean, he was prone to exaggeration. What he really meant, and maybe let's give him the benefit of the doubt, that maybe he misunderstood what patent really meant, but within a patent, you can have 10 or 15 or 100 claims if you want to pay the government enough that you can make. You don't always get them granted, but he actually only had a couple of patents on keyboard percussion instruments, and each one had, of course, multiple, I never added them up, but maybe all the claims added up to 100 and something, but he, you know, in his bio, he said he had, you know, hundreds of patents, but if you actually search the patent office, you only come up with a couple from Claire Omar Musser. Now, he might have been involved in other things at Hughes where he was a participant, but it's not in the public record of the Patent and Trademark Office.
Interesting.
Well, you know, Lee, looking back over your career and the things that I know and the things that I heard you talking about in the Discussions in Percussion podcast, it sounds like, you know, resilience, grit, innovation, and creativity have really been cornerstones in your entire career, kind of everything that you've done. It sounds like you faced some resistance to the new technique and even to an extent, I think, to developing, you know, the marimba as a solo instrument and the one-handed roll and just all of these things. Do you have any maybe career or life advice for young musicians who might be listening?
Well, I have an incredibly snarky quote that Vita Chenoweth said when I asked her the same questions. You want to hear her answer?
I know. Please. This one, yeah. It's good.
She said, amateurs don't listen and geniuses don't need it. And I thought, wow, that's hard. That's harsh, Vita.
And you're sitting there going, so which one am I?
It's one of those. You have to wait and think. Exactly. Let it sink in.
So I don't know. Young players, I think the thing now is, you know, have, it sounds, you know, like cliche, but have fun with it. And I really think if people wrote, somebody would take up the banner on this, and or maybe it's a group of people. Maybe a group of people need to get together and write pieces for young kids that are fun to play with four mallets. You can make a hell of a lot of noise, interesting rhythms. So a drummer can pick up the sticks and in a matter of a month or two, master a piece that's really more about rhythm than, you know, great marimba technique. People could have fun with it. So I think that's the main thing. If you're having fun with it for whatever reason, you continue to work on it and you want to get better at it. And if you make it too didactic and scholarly, it spoils the fun. And that's why I said earlier, you know, holding the sticks, you know, with a vertical hand position and playing your scales with two and three, that can be kind of off-putting. So I would say, let's not do that. Let's do fun things on the marimba or vibes. And then we'll have more people wanting to play those instruments, because they're not easy instruments. I mean, let's face it. You know, I joke around all the time, you know, with my students, you know, it's clarinet, you know, you blow into it, you move your fingers around. Come on. You know, of course, well, I'm not completely serious, because any instrument to play on an artistic level is extremely difficult. But the basics, a flute, clarinet, saxophone, you know, it's not in the same league as marimba, four mallet stuff where you're not touching the instrument, you're not physically in contact with it. It's all spatially so precise. I tell amateur audiences when I talk to groups about the marimba and how I play it, so you can make exactly all the exact right motions with your hands, but if I'm standing 1 inch to the right or the left, they're all wrong notes.
Right, yeah.
So let's just have fun. Let's have fun with it when you're young. And then if you can get people really enthused about those instruments and write music that's fun to play for beginners, that I think is the key. And I'm not going to be the one to do it, so maybe you guys could.
We're heading towards wrapping up, and I just wanted to ask you, what do you think, you know, it's going to be a very just kind of open, vague question, but, you know, what do you think is so good about now versus back then? And I'm going to say back then is whenever you want to think that is. And then vice versa, what do you think we're missing today that we don't have, we had back then?
Well, you know, I don't know whether today's listener to this kind of a podcast can appreciate, or somebody in middle school or high school or whatever, but when I first began to play the marimba as a 16-year-old, a really good music program would have a marimba in the band room. My high school, very good, well-to-do community, had a Keylon 4 1/3 Musser there. But that was unusual. And there was one in the band room. The marimba was not something that individual people owned. It was an institutional purchase. All of the, both the Deegan and the Musser Company, which were the dominant forces, sold their instruments pretty much strictly to institutions, to schools. Have their exceptions, of course. I knew people in college. When I got to college, I think only two of us, Parker Bennett Sherwood III, and I both had our own low-A marimbas. But it was an unusual thing. Now, a good high school program has to have, what, 4 or 6 marimbas or whatever for the WGI business. Yeah. They're everywhere. Individuals have them. High school students interested in percussion buy a 4.3 Paduke or a used instrument. It's no longer just an institutional instrument. It's something that you want to own yourself and have in your house. So, and of course, with that comes all of the differences in the repertoire. It must be impossible for somebody today to conceive of the fact that, again, when I began, was Musser Etudes, it was the Diemer Toccata, Ulrich Suite, Creston Concertino. I'm running out of names. And there was a Tanner, the Tanner Sonata. And, you know, it was, there are 20 pieces. There were, I'm sure, a lot of obscure things as well, but the repertoire was not there. Instrument wasn't really taken seriously. Now you have mainstream composers. Every film score, for gosh sakes, is using the marimba. You can't turn on the TV at night. You can't put Netflix on without hearing the marimba in a film score. It's mm-hmm. It's omnipresent. People own it. People even know what it is. And the opportunities to make music and to enjoy the instrument are vastly greater because there are so many more marimbas and so many more mallets and resources and the repertoire is so vast. So the good old days never were. I mean, the only thing that was good about the good old days was that learning was different. People were taught differently. And because of the access to music being through owning your own music, having an LP collection, coveting this new release that was coming out, you went to the record store and you bought it and you brought it home and you sat down and you listened to it. There was some kind of pride of ownership in building a library of sounds that you owned, that you controlled, that you took care of and prevented people from scratching. And that pride of ownership, I think, on the software side is gone now. People don't care about owning the actual sounds anymore. They may want a good car and a great phone and maybe a great marimba. But on the software side, of course, it's all on the phone. And in theory, it's all available. But nobody really knows the music because you don't own the LP and you don't play it over and over and over again because you love it and you paid for it.
It's so funny you say that because I had this exact conversation, oh my gosh, with my students 2 days ago, and it was exactly about this. You used to have to order the CD from Steve Weiss, wait for it. When it came, it was such a treat, and you'd listen to everything, and even the tracks that you weren't immediately drawn to and didn't love right away, you had to keep listening to them because it's all you had. And as you kept listening, you would learn, you'd acquire new tastes, you would learn to dig deeper into what you were listening to. Whereas now, and I'm guilty of it, I love the internet culture, how quick and easy everything is. The second I'm listening to something I don't want to hear, I just go to the next thing. There's so much stuff waiting for you at the next click that you don't have to dig deeper. You don't have to sit there and live in that discomfort and grow in that discomfort. I just couldn't agree more.
And the flip side of that, of course, is that when I got my first recording of a Bartok string quartet, number one, I played it the first, and I paid $5 for it or whatever I paid. I brought it home and I didn't like it. I thought, wow, this is weird stuff, you know. But then I played it again because I paid $5 for it.
Exactly. You're gonna.
And then I said, oh wait, yeah, those are the glisses. And then by about the third time, I said, holy crap! The wiring started to click in my brain,
exactly.
And I said, holy crap! This is fantastic music.
Right.
And then I wore the record out.
And that's what I mean. Yeah. And if you just had the opportunity to just go, oh, okay, I don't like this, let me find something else, you wouldn't have had that whole discovery.
Yeah. You're not vested in the listening the same way anymore. So, the good old days were good from that standpoint. But from pretty much everything else, the opportunities are just so vast now. I don't know. I don't think it can be put together into a perfect world. You can't. Yeah. We're not going back to those days. And we got to make the best of what we've got today.
I'm actually older than Ben and Carly, so why don't you damn kids wrap this podcast up?
Oh, that reminds me, when we talked to Morris Pulitzer, he actually relatively recently recorded a record, and it's not on any digital format. And like his whole thing is like, he remembers getting that, Led Zeppelin record, and you brought this thing home and you owned it, and just the pride in that and the amount you sat and listened to it.
You're making me think there is something else I wanted to say. It's sort of a segue to that. As many people know, I started out as a rock and roll drummer, got interested in jazz, only then became interested in classical music. And in the past 8 years or so, I've gone back to jazz, not as a player, but because I've been involved in instrument design. I had people come to me and say, Lee, could you do for the vibraphone what you've done over here on the marimba, and could you fix this, and the big multinationals are not listening to us. And so now some of my closest friends are jazz players, the whole Team Omega group of I mentioned Warren Wolf before, Stefan Harris, Joe Locke, Tony Maselli, David Friedman. Well, David's been a friend of mine since the 80s, since the beginning of Malitech, because he was one of the first Malitech guys to have a mallet design with us. But where I was going with this is that I had like zero interest in jazz for a period of like 30 years. It was annoying to me to have to listen to that. My main music is the great orchestral literature. I love Baroque music, Renaissance music. That's what puts me at one with the universe. But I've come back now that my friends are jazz players, and I'm playing a lot of jazz on my stereo systems and appreciating jazz, and it's blowing my mind, just as it happened with Bartok, where at first it's sort of a little annoying, and then as your wiring and your appreciation and your sophistication grows, you then understand the language. So it's been a double gift to me, one to get into the instrument design of vibes, which I never really had. And I'm not a vibes player. I'm not really interested in the vibes. But man, the design element of the vibes has really been a tremendous amount of fun for me over the past 10 years. And it's brought me into a whole new musical world that I never thought I would revisit because my friends are jazzers.
It's been fun to watch all since the Love Vibe. We have two Love Vibes here. And I remember stepping up to a Love Vibe for the first time. And, this is a vibe where you can control the rate of vibrato, everybody. And it's really ingenious design, and it's incredibly clever and useful and cool. But I remember thinking, like, what the heck is... I guess I can see what you could do. I don't know what I would do with this. And then you see Ed Smith play, and you're like, ah... That's why this is amazing.
Do you do Raintree? Do you do other chamber music with vibes? Because
right. It's
not written in there.
That's
the instrument. And if I did that kind of music, that's where I'd want it. But if you have ancient ones, I don't even want to see them because I'm afraid that they must be. Man, that was the original Love Vibe was so freaking complicated with the strings and
We've got ones with strings. Yeah, yeah, they're really. I mean, they still work. They sound great.
It's very, very different instrument now, far more robust. Yeah. But you know what? I mean, it was. You mentioned Ed Smith. Ed walked up to it and in 30 seconds knew what to do with it. It was
I remember that. Yeah.
It's so great. Oh, I love what he does. Yeah.
Psychedelic. I mean, he gets from an acoustic instrument, he gets absolutely psychedelic sounds.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ed said that Bob Shatromo just brought him up and said, "Here, play." And that was the end of it. Well, Lee, wow. as we move toward our wrap up here, I have one sort of final question for you. And I'll start with a funny anecdote. One of my students saw on Facebook that we were having Lee Howard Stevens as a podcast guest this weekend. And he goes, "Oh, that's really cool. I thought he was dead."
Many people wish I were dead. So that's,
and I think the reason that he thought that is because when you have, as the Discussions and Percussion podcast dubbed you, when you have a living legend, that there's so much documented and so much history to this person, it's almost impossible to believe that person is still alive and still making contributions. And one of my favorite books is the Walter Isaacson biography of Steve Jobs. And in that book, he says, I think the last person he wrote a biography on was Albert Einstein. And he says, it's rare to get to ask the person that I'm writing a biography about, what do you want your legacy to be? And so, Lee, if I could ask you as sort of a final question here, what do you want your legacy to be?
Can I lead with a funny anecdote, because tied into what you were saying? So many years ago, we hired an engineer from Cooper Union, really smart kid, Bobby Barkowitz. And Bobby came to work for Malitech. He was involved in the early Love Vibe research, I'm sure. And in any event, he was like a WGI drum corps guy. He played four mallet marimba and everything. So it was really cool, because to have an engineer, first of all, a little peanut of a company, Malitech is a small company, but to have a full-time engineer was a new thing for us. And the guy played the marimba and four mallets. He would work for us for about 18 months. And one day in the middle of a meeting, he went, "Oh shit, you're Lee Howard Stevens." He said, "Your book." He after 18 months, he finally connected his boss with the guy who had written Method of Movement. It was absolutely hilarious moment.
And then he also admitted it.
He didn't know, quote, who I was.
And he admitted it after 18 months.
He exploded at the meeting. His eyes fell out of his head when the realization hit him.
Oh, that's great.
So funny. Yeah.
Well, we got to have this guy on the podcast next, then.
Yeah, I don't know what happened to Bobby, but I'm sure he's got a much better job, much more high pay. But so anyway, legacy thing. This is it's not a difficult question, but it's an embarrassing question, because I have been jumping all over the place, doing so many different things, because unfortunately, I don't know whether it's a narrow attention span or a deep attention span. When I get going in on something, if I'm working on the vibraphone, I get on my back. I've been on my back under a vibraphone a lot, staring up at it, trying to figure out ways to do certain things that I hope will be ready for it to show at BASIC. And so I've been jumping around. If I had spent my entire career just being a performer, I suppose I would be a much better known performer, or composing, or as an educator. I taught for 8 years at the Royal Academy of Music, but I'm no longer, that's the only like straight job I ever really had. And so I've been jumping around doing these different things, design work in the early 80s for the Musser Company, and then my own company, while also running out and performing, teaching, doing a little composing, a lot of transcription and arrangement. So basically, I'm a psychotic. And so it's difficult to really make a particular mark, because in some ways, what I've been doing is so diffuse across a lot of different areas. So I guess to try to answer your question is, I hope that somebody can sort of put it together and realize it's not about the grip, really. You know, it's not about the Bach transcriptions or playing polyphonically or the one-handed roll, but it's sort of the, it's the bigger picture I think I've accomplished a lot of separate little things that are difficult to put into one package. So I hope that the legacy somehow or other can come together so that people can appreciate how psychotic my life has been. I don't know if psychotic is the right word, but I think you guys understand.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thanks so much to Lee for joining us today. And thank you to everyone that submitted Facebook questions. There were just so many, we couldn't possibly get to all of them, but we wanted to thank those that submitted that we didn't get to today. And I think Casey has that list.
Yeah, sure. So thanks everyone for the questions as always. Alec Johnstone, Ted Jackson, our buddy Bob McCormick, Matthew Clark, Ryan Carlisle, Nick Barnes, and Matthew Lorick were the ones who still had questions unanswered. So yeah, thanks everybody.
Cool. Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. And we will see you guys on episode 199.
Yeah. Thank you, Lee.
Good night.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Good night.
All right. Bye, everybody.